Ladies and gentlemen, we should get started. It's my privilege to introduce the speaker today. My name is Olaf Slaymaker. I'm an emeritus professor of geography here at UBC. And I have been for some time a member of this graduate and faculty Christian Fellowship, which is a collection of graduate students and faculty members who are impressed with the thought that faith and scholarship need to go together and need to be mutually queried, and that we need to examine our faith at the same time as we examine our scholarship. This UBC Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum meets on a monthly basis, and our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February the 22nd, when Dr. Ratch will be speaking to us, and look forward to seeing you at that time. But the important business of the afternoon is to listen to Professor John Stackhouse. We're honored to have Professor Stackhouse here. One of those nice things that happened since about 40 years ago when I first came to UBC, and Regent College didn't exist. And since that time, there's been sort of various viewpoints at UBC on the relationship with Regent College, which now has really come of age, and where the benefits to UBC of the presence of Regent College have become enlarged. And in particular, I'd like to express my personal thanks to John for the way in which he has, as a public theologian, addressed matters of faith and scholarship in a much more upfront way than many of us have succeeded in over the last 40 years. So let me just say then that Professor Stackhouse is the Sangwoo Yutong Chi, I think that's the correct pronunciation, Professor of Theology and Culture at Regent College. He was raised in Canada. He gained his first class BA at Queen's in Religious Studies and History. He then moved on to Wheaton College in Illinois, where he completed his master's, and the University of Chicago, where he completed his PhD. He's taught at colleges and universities in both the United States and in Canada, where he lectures regularly. And he's also served as an adjunct professor of religious studies at McGill, and he's presently at UBC supervising a number of graduate students here on the campus. So you see, the relationship has indeed grown much more intimate as between our two institutions. Professor Stackhouse is the author of 5 books, some of which you can actually purchase. I understand. Just got one myself at 20% off. You might even persuade Professor Stackhouse to sign one of these. His publishers include Oxford University Press, the University of Toronto Press, and the Baker Bookhouse. He's the editor of 4 volumes and the author of many articles. But he's best known, I suspect, to all of us from his public presentations over radio and television, in which he does not shy away from controversial issues and presents a most straightforward and clear explanation of where Christian thinkers stand on subjects of contemporary concern. So it's my great privilege to introduce Professor Stackhouse, to welcome him here, and to thank him for taking the time to be with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see if our microphone works. Does that add a little bit of volume to things? Good. Well, it's delightful to be back on the UBC campus again. I was here a week or so ago, meeting with the committee on the PhD student that's my privilege to supervise over here. Olaf suggested that I supervise a number of PhD students over here, and that's true. That number is one. I'm delighted to work with George Edgerton and Mark Vesey and other distinguished members of the UBC faculty in that regard. Great to be back also with the student and faculty fellowship here at UBC. In fact, if I were a member of the audience today, I would feel that it's always a great thrill to welcome and to listen to the lecture of a world-class scholar speaking about an area of research in which he is an acknowledged master, delivering forth brilliant insights and a wealth of tremendous wisdom on a subject for which he is known across the globe. This will not be one of those lectures today. Instead, you have to settle for something much more modest. For one thing, me, and then secondly, a lecture that is, in fact, a work in progress. I have come more lately to the study of Reinhold Niebuhr. I'll explain in a minute later than perhaps I should have. And it would have been pleasant to give you one of my more polished lectures today, but I suspect I'm among friends, and if not, at least civil colleagues. And I'd like instead to try out on you some of my ongoing research. The study of Niebuhr is part of a book project I have contracted with Oxford to do over the next year and a half on a theology of culture, on what it means to be a Christian in the world, and particularly in our world. And among the subjects I'm studying is the work and career of Reinhold Niebuhr. And so out of that larger study, which will also include examination of his brother Richard Niebuhr, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, C.S. Lewis, and a few other folk as well, I thought I would try to bring you something today from that. So in that regard, I will speak for a while, and then I will be delighted to hear questions and comments from you that will be a favor to me, no matter how critical they may be, because I'd much rather hear them now than when I'm committed to print in a couple of years. So bring it on today, and then I still can change things and, of course, give you the appropriate citation. Reinhold Niebuhr, Prophet of Christian Realism. When Harvard University sought a keynote speaker for its 350th anniversary celebration in 1986, an occasion which called for a public intellectual with a commanding presence who could speak across the disciplines, American literature professor Alan Heimert told President Derek Bok that only two people in the last several decades could have made that speech, Walter Lippmann and Reinhold Niebuhr, and they were both gone. While Reinhold Niebuhr claimed to be, in his words, only an ethicist, apologist, and preacher, Time, Life, and Saturday magazines all acclaimed him on behalf of middlebrow America as America's premier theologian in the mid-20th century. An indefatigable speaker in colleges, universities, churches, conferences, political rallies, and other venues, until a stroke halted him in 1952 in his 60th year. Niebuhr also authored 21 books, contributed to 126 more, and wrote at least 2,600 articles. In September 1964, President Lyndon Johnson awarded him the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Yet, Reinhold Niebuhr has been assailed as a chaplain to power who helped legitimize American imperialism and self-righteousness during the Cold War. His view, known as Christian realism, has been accused of promoting an unchristian defeatism, a willingness to compromise with evil, and a repudiation of the transforming power of God. And perhaps worst of all, when once he had the attention not only of Christian America, but of America itself, Reinhold Niebuhr is now largely ignored by younger theologians, Christian activists, and society at large. I myself was challenged to consider Niebuhr carefully by not one but two senior theologians in my life. My former professor, the late Langdon Gilkey at the University of Chicago, whose fine book on Niebuhr I have only just recently read. And also the man who founded the Department of Religion at the University of Manitoba and whom I succeeded as a young professor of age 30, the late Gordon Harland, whose single important book was a study of Reinhold Niebuhr. These men told me and told me and told me that I should study Niebuhr, and I knew better until now. I very much regret that I have come so late to the study of Niebuhr that I cannot now tell these departed brethren how right they were to commend Niebuhr to me. So what is Christian realism, and why should we care now, some three decades after Reinhold Niebuhr's death in 1971? Let's begin by asking the question, then, is Christianity realistic? The first thing to acknowledge in any discussion of Christian realism, especially before an audience of academicians, some of whom are not themselves Christian believers, is that there is a very long and now academically dominant tradition in Western civilization that would say that Christian realism must be a contradiction in terms. Indeed, religion in general is not realistic, but instead fantastic, fabulous, illusory, misguided, and misguiding. Sociologist Rodney Stark provides a brief catalog of social scientific luminaries who share this low opinion of religion, and of Christianity in particular, quoting now. Thomas Hobbes, one of the celebrated founders of social science, dismissed all religion as, quote, credulity, ignorance, and lies, and the gods as creatures of fancy, unquote. A century later, David Hume echoed Hobbes, dismissing all belief in miracles as limited to ignorant and barbarous nations. During the 19th century, anti-religious social science was rampant. Auguste Comte coined the word sociology to identify a new field that would replace religious, quote, hallucinations, unquote, as the guide to morals. Then Ludwig von Feuerbach discovered that humans create gods in their own image, while Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels found God in the economy, busy sanctifying wage slavery. At the start of the 20th century, the famous French sociologist Émile Durkheim taught that the fundamental reality is that society itself is always the true object of religious worship. Quote, God can be nothing else than society itself, personified and represented to the imagination, end quote. Along came Sigmund Freud, who explained on just one page of his celebrated psychoanalytic expose of faith, The Future of an Illusion, that religion is, quote, an illusion, a sweet or bittersweet poison, a neurosis, an intoxicant, and childishness to be overcome. It's quite a page. Even more recently, no reviewer as much as flinched when on the first page of his book, Mystical Experience, Benami Scharfstein revealed that, quote, mysticism is a name for the paranoid darkness in which unbalanced people stumble so confidently, end quote. And went on to identify the supernatural as, quote, a fairy tale, end quote. And in similar fashion, Oxford's distinguished Brian Wilson has identified, quote, supernaturalist thinking, quote, as simply, quote, an indulgence, end quote, and the end of Stark's catalog. I take the time to quote this catalog because Reinhold Niebuhr was well aware of this settled prejudice against religion, and particularly the dominant religion of the West, Christianity. In the teeth of it, in fact, he both embraced social science, integrating it fully into his way of looking at the world, and also judged it to be deficient, precisely in the light of the religion so many social scientists had been so willing to despise. Indeed, Niebuhr's fundamental public claim for Christianity is that it does a better job, a more rationally satisfying, as well as more existentially satisfying, job of explaining the world than does any other worldview, including the worldviews of Hobbes, Hume, Comte, Marx, Freud, or anyone else. Far from being an escape from reality into narcotic aspirations or comforting wish fulfillment, Christianity, Niebuhr maintained, is the most realistic view of things on offer. I would like now, then, to exposit Christian realism under three themes: epistemology, human nature, and history. What is Christian realism? Epistemology. we properly draw on experience to tell us what we can know of the world. This was Niebuhr's contention, and by experience he meant both formal scientific study of the world and also introspective analysis of ourselves. In this, he was truly Western and modern in this empiricist sense. Furthermore, Niebuhr so relied on experience that he believed that if this or that form of analysis has proved unfruitful or even results in evil, then we should abandon it. Early in his career, he did exactly this. He was a Marxist who understood Marxist categories to be the most helpful way to understand social life in America and elsewhere. And over the course of his career, he became disillusioned, not only with Stalinism in Russia, but Marxism as an intellectual construct, and turned on communism later in life, not only as a political movement, but also as an intellectual device. In particular, Niebuhr shows his concern to draw on experience and to let experience teach us, in that he allowed, eventually, his genuine analysis of British culture to correct his earlier mythologization of that nation as a foil for criticizing America. Perhaps it will strike some of you, especially from Britain, as a bit charming that Niebuhr, early in his career, used Britain in an idealized sense as a stick with which to beat deficient America. And then as he actually got to know Britain better, he did that less and less. So Niebuhr himself showed that he was willing to submit to reality as understood through experience. Experience is the source in which we draw to tell us what we know of the world, and if a particular mode of analysis or a particular body of data prove to be deficient, then we must discard them for something better. But having said that, he also contended that what we can find out that way prompts us to realize that we cannot know at all, and that mystery is an irreducible element in any adequate description of the world. Long before postmodernism arose as a common term, let alone a watchword of cultural sophistication, Niebuhr recognized that human reason has the paradoxical quality of both being able to transcend itself, to keep learning, to critique its own previous opinions, and to creatively form new ways of thinking, and yet also to recognize its finitude, that its sense of reality and its reflections upon reality were always beams of light in an indefinably larger darkness. Thus, Niebuhr was impressed with the relativity of all human knowledge, but also with its finitude and with its recognition of its own finitude. We ourselves, he affirms, know that we cannot know at all, even about ourselves, let alone about the origin and destiny of our race, let alone of the universe itself. Therefore, the best worldview is one that properly identifies both human ability and human limitation. To put it more pointedly, any worldview, philosophy, or religion that provides a comprehensive and coherent account of reality is necessarily false. It is leaving out too much and is substituting the part for the whole. Without, and I speak paradoxically here, and in the next hour you're going to get sick of paradox, perhaps, or you'll be entranced by it, but there's plenty of it. Without a coherent inclusion of the category of mystery, any explanation of the world is reductionistic. Further then, Niebuhr maintains that Christian theology provides the best conceptuality to articulate this reality. God created and sustains the world and made us able to understand it. But his ways are above our ways, and thus we will not be able to investigate or interpret it fully. It's interesting to me, looking at Niebuhr at the beginning of the 21st century, how he brings together analysis of the world and analysis of theological resources, believes that those both must be undertaken and then brought into conversation. To put this in somewhat more contemporary terms, the interaction of praxis and theoria must be in dialectic is a theme that Niebuhr is already working in the 1940s, a generation or so before liberation and feminist theologies bring that kind of nexus more into the mainstream of some theological schools. Langdon Gilkey says this: "The Christian scheme of meaning Niebuhr argued, makes more sense than the others on three important grounds. First, it makes intelligible the contradictions and confusions of ordinary and especially historical experience. Second, it deals most creatively with the deep anxieties of being human. And third, it guards against the twin perils of idolatry and despair. To him, each of the secular alternatives to biblical faith takes some finite and partial aspect of human life as both ultimate and saving. This inevitably leads, on the one hand, to reflective misunderstanding, and on the other, it creates the condition for idolatry. End quote. Let's listen now to Niebuhr himself. Since I am not so much scholar as preacher, I must confess that the gradual unfolding of my theological ideas has come not so much through study as through the pressure of world events. Whatever measure of Christian faith I hold today is due to the gradual exclusion of alternative beliefs through world history. As did the Apostle Peter, I would preface my confession, "Thou hast words of eternal life," with the question, "Lord, to whom shall we go?" Even while imagining myself to be preaching the gospel earlier in my career, I had really experimented with many alternatives to Christian faith, until one by one they proved unavailing. End quote. Perhaps we can use an image in this case for Niebuhr's confidence and concern for the bringing together of experience and Christian theological categories as a way of investigating and living in the world without claiming too much for that investigation, without in fact claiming either to know it all through empirical analysis or to understanding it all through theological categories. Think of traveling on railroad tracks. If your objective in traveling down the tracks is to get to the end place where they meet, then you'll be forever frustrated. But if your objective is to travel, to learn more and to improve your understanding of the world, then the ride will be worthwhile. So Niebuhr's sense was, don't look for that kind of closure, it'll never come. But if you're willing to settle for more than you have, more truth, more light, more beauty than you have, then by all means, carry on. Niebuhr maintained that God has provided information and insight that we could never have discovered on our own. And thus, he believes strongly in the Christian category of revelation. As he says, faith in God depends upon faith in his power to reveal himself. The Christian faith is God's self-disclosure, culminating in the revelation of Christ. And this is the basis of the Christian concept of personality and individuality. End quote. For example, we recognize, whether we're Christian or not, that we both do good and do evil, and that everyone does so. We further recognize that no one lives up to his or her own moral code, let alone any pure universal standard that may be held up by a god or gods. We also recognize that we regret much or all of our misbehavior, and yet we continue to perform similar acts. Reinhold Niebuhr suggests that these phenomena all deserve attention. None should be ignored in the interest of formulating a tidy moral anthropology. And that the Christian theological category of sin, as revealed in the Bible and exposited in the Christian tradition, offers a category that is both intellectually and existentially satisfying. That's an example of what I mean, of how Niebuhr then believes that this revelation given to us by God offers us both insight and information into phenomena we already experience. To reveal truth in a way that properly balances various elements and communicates well across a variety of cultures, God has resorted to the genre of story, of myth, understood as a narrative and symbol set that articulate abiding truth. This is what God does in the Bible. He tells us this is the way things are and have been. But here Niebuhr departs from the Christian tradition, because Christian tradition has believed that God has actually given us also historical truth. This is the way things actually were. And Niebuhr doesn't believe that. Instead, he believes that most of the Bible, not all, but most of the Bible gives us instead illustrative story as a way of illuminating our experience. Again, the doctrine of sin furnishes a rich example. Christian tradition says that our first parents, Adam and Eve, were created morally innocent. And then they chose to sin, thus infecting themselves and their descendants with a disposition to continue sinning. This idea, in brief, is the doctrine of original sin. Now, Niebuhr is orthodox in that he believes we all are indeed affected by sin in the core of our beings. We are not basically good people who strangely and occasionally commit evil. But we are deeply conflicted people who recognize within our souls both a desire to do good, Niebuhr connects this with the biblical image of God motif, and a desire to do evil, which he connects with the biblical idea of original sin. The biblical narrative of sin, Reinhold Niebuhr maintains, best depicts our lived reality, a reality that analytical, ontological speech can clarify to some extent, but does so at the risk of, to borrow a Wordsworthian phrase, murdering to dissect. The story, the biblical story, by contrast, keeps all of the elements together and in proper relation in a way that Niebuhr felt ontology could not. So far, then, for Niebuhr being orthodox. But Niebuhr is often called neo-orthodox. And in this respect, he does not believe in a literal Adam and Eve. He simply takes for granted the evolutionary theory of his day, and presumes then that this Bible story is a myth, a narrative that does not describe an event in the past, but refers to our perennial human predicament. Niebuhr does not believe that the whole Bible is mythological in this way. He seems to be more literalistic in this sense about the career of Jesus. But he does hold to this view of biblical myth as the most helpful way for us to appropriate the ongoingly relevant truth revealed in Scripture. So, to conclude this section on epistemology, Christian realism, therefore, is epistemologically realistic in terms of both metaphysics and morality. First, metaphysics. Christianity, Niebuhr maintains, helps us to see the world the way it really is, ourselves, each other, the planet, and God. So in that sense, it is metaphysically realistic. And secondly, it is realistic as to do with morality. Christianity helps us to see that morality is not merely a construct of individual preference or social convention. Right and wrong are as given in the cosmos as are, say, mass or extension. But this realism of Niebuhr's must be qualified, as he does, by the previous acknowledgments of both mystery and myth. We do not see everything, nor do we see anything so clearly and comprehensively that we can claim certainty for our perceptions and our inferences. And much of what we do see is expressed best in story, in myth, and not in the discursive speech preferred by most scientists and philosophers. Indeed, we can go on to say that these epistemological acknowledgments are themselves realistic. They conform to the way things really are, the way we are, the way the world is, the way God is, and so on. And finally, Reinhold Niebuhr's epistemological realism is qualified not only by our limitations, but also by our faults, namely, our sin. This theme, then, of human nature, we will explore next. Human beings have a twofold nature. We are creatures and thus human, of the humus of the earth, finite in awareness, in ability, in mortality. I didn't say immortality, but in mortality. But we are also created in the image of God, and thus enjoy transcendence. To get beyond ourselves, to see ourselves, to get beyond the present circumstances, to imagine and create a new situation, and to aspire to get beyond ourselves and this world to arrive at a more glorious destiny. This is what Niebuhr says, quote, "The obvious fact is that man is a child of nature, subject to its vicissitudes, compelled by its necessities, driven by its impulses, and confined within the brevity of years which nature permits its various organic forms. The other, less obvious fact is that man is a spirit who stands outside of nature, life, himself, his reason, and the world." Continuing on with Niebuhr, "In its purest form, the Christian view of man regards man as a unity of godlikeness and creatureliness, in which he remains a creature even in the highest spiritual dimensions of his existence, and may reveal elements of the image of God even in the lowest aspects of his natural life." End quote. In this, we might recall, Niebuhr echoes the biblical psalmist. Psalm 8, "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you've established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? Yet you have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands. You put all things under their feet." Human beings have the ability to choose what to believe, feel, and do to a considerable extent. And yet we are also bound in our beliefs, feelings, and actions, not only by our intrinsic creaturely limitations, but also by our sin. Reading from Niebuhr. "The Christian view of human nature is involved in the paradox of claiming a higher stature for man and of taking a more serious view of his evil than other anthropology. The high estimate of the human stature implied in the concept image of God stands in paradoxical juxtaposition to the low estimate of human virtue in Christian thought. Man is a sinner. His sin is defined as rebellion against God. The Christian estimate of human evil is so serious precisely because it places evil at the very center of human personality, in the will. This evil cannot be regarded complacently as the inevitable consequence of his finiteness or the fruit of his involvement in the contingencies and necessities of nature. Sin is occasioned precisely by the fact that man refuses to admit his creatureliness and to acknowledge himself as merely a member of a total unity of life. He pretends to be more than he is. Nor can he dismiss his sins as residing in that part of himself which is not his true self, that is, that part of himself which is involved in physical necessity. Man is not divided against himself so that the essential man can be extricated from the non-essential. Man contradicts himself within the terms of his true essence. His essence is free self-determination. His sin is the wrong use of his freedom and its consequent destruction." End quote. Actually, this is one of the great treats of lecturing on someone like Reinhold Niebuhr or Dietrich Bonhoeffer or C.S. Lewis, is that you get to actually just recite their prose instead. You know, it's one thing for me to get up and play my own music, but it's fun to sit at the piano and play Bach, too. So you can tell this is why this guy was listened to. This is the way he writes all the time. I don't know what he'd be like at home, but he was pretty impressive in public. Thus, Niebuhr champions a biblical anthropology over the extant alternatives, whether Marxian, psychoanalytical, sociobiological, liberal Christian, or otherwise. All of these alternatives are reductionistic in just this way. They fail to take into account, and into proper, balanced, and paradoxical account, both human freedom and responsibility, and also human bondage and our need for salvation from a source outside ourselves. So we come third to to history. Reinhold Niebuhr believed that human beings can look forward to a great destiny by the grace of God. This world is not all there is, and there is a better world ahead. But listen to how he puts this. Quoting, "The biblical symbols cannot be taken literally because it is not possible for finite minds to comprehend that which transcends and fulfills history." End quote. More memorably, perhaps, Reinhold Niebuhr quipped, quoting, "It's unwise for Christians to claim any knowledge of either the furniture of heaven or the temperature of hell, or to be too certain about any details of the kingdom of God in which history is consummated." End quote. Now, we might say, fair enough. But Niebuhr goes on in his extended discussion at the conclusion of his great work, The Nature and Destiny of Man, to proclaim the second coming of Christ as a vindication of Christ and of God's redeeming love, the last judgment, which both affirms the hope that evil will not continue and confirms the truth that history will not redeem itself, and the resurrection as the vindication of the meaningfulness of our historical existence, versus the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, which in Greek and Indian thought tends to negate the value of our historical bodily life. So as much as Niebuhr says we can't take these with complete literal seriousness, he then goes on to exposit exactly some of the most controversial and important themes of Christian eschatology as essential for understanding of the limitations of this historical existence and our need for a God who will rescue us from the vicissitudes and difficulties of this existence. And at the same time, as he rescues us, he also affirms the importance of this historical existence. This is no Gnostic God who seeks to yank divine sparks out of physical and bodily prisons into some kind of spiritual ether. Instead, this is a God who says the body does matter, and that's why I'm going to resurrect you all into a new historical existence that is simultaneously a judgment upon and a vindication of the historical process. The paradoxes, as you can tell, are piling up on the floor around us as we continue our discussion. In the meanwhile, then, looking forward to this final vindication of history and of Jesus Christ, our duty, Niebuhr said, as Christians, is to approximate the goodness of that better world in full and prudent realization of the limitations of this one. And this is the ethical stance for which Niebuhr is perhaps best known, the stance of working for the best while expecting resistance, confusion, compromise, trade-offs, and sometimes even failure. Niebuhr, in fact, concludes his masterpiece, The Nature and Destiny of Man, with these words, quote, "By its confidence in an eternal ground of existence which is, nevertheless, involved in man's historical striving to the very point of suffering with and for him, this Christian faith can prompt men to accept their historical responsibilities gladly. Thus, wisdom about our destiny is dependent upon a humble recognition of the limits of our knowledge and our power. Our most reliable understanding is the fruit of grace, in which faith completes our ignorance without pretending to possess its certainties as knowledge, and in which contrition mitigates our pride without destroying our hope." End quote. So given this brief exposition of some of the main themes, arguably the main themes in Niebuhr's thought, I'd like to talk with you now in the last part of my address as to what Niebuhr might say to us today. Probably not, John, but I will try. I also have a little bit of a problem sometimes hearing. How are you at the back? Are you able to hear all right? I suspect it's a bit of a trick of the room, too, as to which way the acoustics are. I think there's a single speaker behind this screen, pointed backward, bouncing out over to you. I think there must be some engineer in UBC's acoustics department who set that up just perfectly for everyone except John. But I will try to speak a little louder if I can. The first of the fruits of the harvest I'd like to offer to you is the question, and in fact the theme, of the importance of empiricism. A former teacher of mine wrote a book within my faith community, which is evangelical Protestantism, some years ago called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, in which Mark Knoll suggested that the scandal of the evangelical mind is that there isn't much of an evangelical mind. Many of us who live within that community know exactly whereof he speaks. But among the themes that Mark Knoll raises is a very interesting one about the way many evangelicals tend to look at the world. And that is something that I would call biblicistic non-empiricism. You can tell that Knoll didn't use that term because of its inelegance. But I think it is helpful, nonetheless, as a kind of biblicistic non-empiricism. Very briefly, Knoll suggests that a constant and failing trait of the way evangelicals look at the world is not, in fact, to look at the world, but to simply look at their Bibles as to what they think the Bible says about the world. He uses as an example the conflict in the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq. I wrote this book 10 years ago, so this was in the War of George I. Right? And in this book, he suggests that when there was conflict in Iraq, evangelicals looked at biblical prophecies and then tried to connect the dots with various facts they were reading from their newspapers and thought that they were then describing what was happening in the Middle East. And what Knoll says is that they actually should have just looked at the Middle East. They should have just looked with their God-given reason at the world God has given us and not tried to look at it only through this contentious biblical filter. Now, please understand, Mark Knoll is himself an evangelical Christian, a Bible-believing Orthodox Presbyterian. But what he's saying is that we foolishly cut ourselves off from understanding the world if we indulge in what I would call this biblicistic non-empiricism. And in fact, routinely, evangelicals misunderstand what they're looking at because they insist on, in fact, not looking at it, but looking at what they propose the Bible says about it, rather than looking at it and then looking at what the Bible might say to help us understand it better. Bad enough if this pattern of non-empiricism was confined to evangelicals. It might have been a few decades ago, as Olaf perhaps was implying, that sensible people could say, well, that's what one would expect from a benighted population like evangelicals. But now that George W. Bush is in his second term, no one finds this unimportant anymore, because this worldview is helping to, in fact, construct geopolitics all around us. And it was actually operative quite strongly in the Reagan White House when I lived down there, in which, again, people thought they were looking at the world, but they were really looking at certain ideological categories and substituting those for the world. Would that this were true only of ideologues on the right? But of course it isn't. It's true also of those on the left, on the right, and in between. Data are just fitted into the pre-existing theory, and not even industriously sought, since the theory is right. We don't actually need to look very hard, because we already know. That is a danger, of course, that is not the problem of any particular position on the ideological spectrum. It is a human problem, and Niebuhr was quick to pounce on that problem wherever he saw it. This determination of Niebuhr's to investigate reality and to keep seeking more truth is in fact a stance of both epistemic and metaphysical humility. We are, as it were, submitting to reality, at least as we perceive it, recognizing our small, limited place in the scheme of things. As Christians, we thus serve God and our fellow creatures aright because we're serving them according to the way things really are, rather than attempting to distort reality to suit our preferences, which, as psychiatrist Scott Peck reminds us, is a fundamental trait not only of mental illness, but of evil. One interesting implication of this emphasis on empiricism for Niebuhr is one he addresses to preachers and teachers alike regarding the very important task of both exhortation and education, and that is of persuasion. Niebuhr says this, and to a room of educated people, I think this is particularly interesting, especially in a room of professors. He says, I'm a preacher and I like to preach, but I don't think many people are influenced by admonition. Admonitions to be more loving are, on the whole, irrelevant. What is relevant are analyses of the human situation that discuss the levels of human possibilities and of sin. What Niebuhr's saying, I think, is that people may resist our moral exhortation, but we have to help people see the way things are. And if we simply analyze then, this is the way things are, this is what will happen if you choose this moral path instead of that, that will be much more efficacious than if we simply try to exhort people to do what we want them to do. Much more persuasive to show things empirically than to simply exhort people. It's interesting, by the way, I've come across very similar passages in C.S. Lewis. Lewis also believes that moral admonition is, on the whole, generally useless. It's much more important to expose people to reality, and then they're going to choose which way they're going to go. At least they will be more clear about where their self-interest really does lie. People may resist our moral teaching, but we must try to help them see that they are resisting not us or our opinions or our wishes, but reality, the way things really are. Well, a few remarks about the importance of empiricism. Secondly, about the existence of sin. There has been a lot of unhappy history since Reinhold Niebuhr's day. In American history, his country has lived through Vietnam, Watergate, the Iran-Contra affair, the savings and loan debacle, Drexel, Enron, 9/11. Internationally, we have all witnessed and to some extent suffered through, among other things, the events in Rwanda, in Yugoslavia, and the Sudan. And for us, right here, close to home, we have seen successive British Columbian provincial governments mired in personal and political scandal. Reinhold Niebuhr would ask us about recognizing the presence and power of sin in us all. Do we get it? He would ask us. Do we? Or are we still shocked by this, as if it is a terrible surprise that people can act this way, rather than a dark reality to be taken into account and dealt with? So on the one hand, and Niebuhr is almost always a one hand on the other hand kind of guy, on the one hand, we should be taking into account and not being shocked by sin, but in fact being realistic about it, presuming its existence, in fact. But just as unrealistic, Niebuhr would say, are those of us who still think that we can just solve whatever's wrong. Or at least the important people can, if only they would just get busy. As the headline of a column in the satirical newspaper, The Onion, once put it, why doesn't somebody just fix all the problems? It's that kind of attitude that Niebuhr was also pretty insistent upon against his fellow liberals. Why indeed? And that brings us to our third category, the necessity of realism. Niebuhr saw his emphasis on realism to lie between cynicism and idealism. By our own efforts, he said, there will be no arrival at the end of history. There will be no realization of the ultimate society, since, to coin a phrase from the flower power days, wherever we go, there we are. But some societies, nonetheless, are better than others. And we can and must work for the most justice and the most human flourishing that we can. The implication, then, from a Niebuhrian point of view, is that we opt, among other things, for the best of the real choices in a political election, rather than either refusing to vote, which does nothing to resist the most evil of the choices, or, secondly, voting for the most pure candidate, who in many cases will certainly lose. Niebuhr is well known for chiding us for the sin of pride, in thinking that we can replace the current order with one that will work nicely for everyone, We're congratulating ourselves that we've already achieved a perfectly just order in this or that institution. Quoting Niebuhr, Western culture has paid for the boon of historical dynamic with two evils inhering in the historical emphasis. One is the evil of fanaticism, the consequence of giving ultimate significance to historically contingent goals and values. The other is the creative but also confusing messianism, the hope for a heaven on earth, for a kingdom of universal peace and righteousness. End of quote. And communism was Niebuhr's first example of this latter form of self-delusion, messianism. But having chided us about pride, he also chides us for the complementary sin, so to speak, and it is a sin that is perhaps in more need of exposure today than it was in Niebuhr's day. Today, in our time of greater doubt, even despair, over the possibility of real, lasting, and beneficial transformation of ourselves or of the institutions in which we work, in this day, not of overweening confidence, which was Niebuhr's day in mid-century USA, but in our day, where we seem to think that no one can ever do anything, and we don't expect anyone to solve all the problems, Niebuhr warns us not only against pride, but also against what he calls sensuality, what Karl Barth perhaps more helpfully called sloth. And in an unusual and important sense, sensuality, according to Niebuhr, is the abandonment of our freedom to take refuge in the status quo. Quoting him, sensuality represents an effort to escape from the freedom and the infinite possibilities of spirit by becoming lost in the detailed processes, activities, and interests of existence, an effort which results inevitably in unlimited devotion to limited values. End quote. Robin Lovin explains, quote, and I know this is late in the lecture, late in an afternoon, it's getting kind of dim, but this is actually one of the coolest things I have to say. So if you can sort of find whatever last little bit of stimulus is in that caffeine you drank, I hope you can sort of turn it on now and listen to these last 5-10 minutes. I find this particularly helpful for some of us in the academic world. So Robin Lovin explains, quote, what marks sensuality is that it holds anxiety at bay by total absorption in an activity that raises no questions beyond itself. Sin is present not merely in the ambition that remakes the world to suit its own plans, but also in the sensuality that loses itself in immediate possibilities, in the sloth that absorbs itself in petty concerns and excuses its mediocre performance, and even in the disciplined pursuit of excellences that have been carefully defined by someone else. Unless persons and nations are straining towards a good that stands in judgment on every concrete form of excellence they know and have achieved, they have yielded to the temptations of sensuality and of sloth. In their anxiety, they have sought to achieve freedom by denying that they're free. And this is true, paradoxically enough, even for those heirs of Puritanism who compound the contradiction by working very hard at being slothful. For example, in business, the arts, and in scholarship. Now, how can this be? I'd like to dwell on this point particularly for this academic audience. Lovin goes on. Quote, those who find their work meaningless and who lack significant personal relationships will find, I don't mean us now, I'd like to think, but maybe some of you do. Okay, those who find their work meaningless and who lack significant personal relationships will find much encouragement in a consumer-oriented society to devote themselves to new forms of gadgetry and to establish a firm, decorative control over their limited personal environment. These evasions of freedom, along with the forms of indulgence more usually associated with sensuality, must be seen as genuine forms of sin. But we must also identify a form of institutional sin that elicits sensuality or sloth from persons by demanding commitments that preclude responsible attention to the range of choices and responsibilities that they ought to be attending to for themselves. The up or out, publish or perish career trajectories imposed by businesses, law firms, and academic institutions provide familiar examples of this sort of pressure. And those who yield to these pressures are often pictured as ambitious, fast-track achievers, whose chief temptation would seem to be to emulate the pride of their seniors and superiors, In fact, however, their achievements are often expressions of sensuality and sloth. The rising executive or scholar abandons the difficult balancing of obligations that marks a life of freedom constrained by human finitude and substitutes a single set of goals defined by outside authorities. The overachiever stills anxiety in precisely the way that Niebuhr describes the sensual evasion, by finding a God in a person or process outside the self. End quote. So Levin concludes, true humanity must both choose these excellences and know their limits by finding a God. True humanity must both choose these excellences and know their limits, both struggle to master them and constantly question their worth. End quote. Niebuhr's realism, then, the belief that there is indeed a transcendent standard that both judges us and lures us on to excellence, thus chastens the modern idea of progress for its pride, and also chastens the postmodern idea of radical relativism for its despair. Then, the viability of hope. And with these, I'll speak a little more briefly, and I'd like to hear from you in a few minutes. All of our efforts to promote goodness in the world, Niebuhr believes, are blessed under providence. And at the true end of history, all will be well. In the meanwhile, then, we labor in hope, recognizing always the limitedness and defects that affect all our work. Quoting Niebuhr, if the Christian conception of grace be true, then all history remains an interim between the disclosure in Christ and the fulfillment of its meaning at the end of the world. This interim is characterized by actual corruptions, as well as by partial realizations and approximations of the meaning of life. Redemption does not guarantee elimination of the sinful corruptions, which are in fact increased whenever the redeemed claim to be completely emancipated from them. But the taint of sin upon all historical achievements does not destroy the possibility of such achievements, nor the obligation to realize truth and goodness in history. The fulfillments of meaning in history will be the more untainted, in fact, if purity is not prematurely claimed for them. All historical activities stand under this paradox of grace. End quote. And so the requirement of action. Reinhold Niebuhr's daughter testifies that the family customarily spent most of their supper times talking about politics, which is interesting in a preacher's home who's got a title of professor of ethics. Niebuhr engaged in political action himself, considerable political action. He made speeches that were political speeches on behalf of candidates. He had various party involvements. He was involved in an early political action committee. He actually ran for office once himself, was thoroughly trounced. And he made various public endorsements of political figures. And Niebuhr's approach to politics increasingly over his life became pragmatic in the everyday sense of the word. He believed that political results matter more even than academic purity and thoroughness. He struggled, actually, to find a time to write even The Nature and Destiny of Man, his Gifford lectures, because he was so interested in participating in the politics of his day. Now, most of us, if we were invited to offer the Giffords, we might just book off a couple of years and settle down and write the books. But for him, as interesting as it was to write these, he still had these various campaigns. And, of course, in America, where there's an election every 2 years, you're always thinking about elections. Thus, Niebuhr affirms politics as a worthy sphere of Christian work. Indeed, yes, politics is the art of the possible. Yes, it is the art of making the best of things together. And Niebuhr would say, yes, we do that without the illusion that we are simply and only building the kingdom of God on earth. Niebuhr was, I think, a pretty clear-eyed realist about this. Some would say jaundiced, I think more clear. There is not always a pure choice available in politics or in any other sphere of life. There often, not always, but there often is not a pure choice available. Yes, our motives will never be pure, and yes, there will be unintended and unwelcome consequences. Niebuhr took that all on board, But he said, we're not victims of tragedy or fate. God is responsible for what God's responsible for, and we are responsible too. And the world requires well-intentioned, well-conceived, and well-executed action that nonetheless, because we are who we are, will result in some evil. But we must nonetheless press on, seeking forgiveness for the impurity of our motives, seeking restitution for the evil results of our actions, but we press on regardless to do what we can. Niebuhr was very clear about this and insistent upon this, much to the scandal of Christians then and now. We must not be, he said, fastidious in a broken, heaving world and seek to keep our hands clean. Now, this is my own language, so you can't actually blame Niebuhr for this, but I think this is a fair summary of his view. We must not be fastidious in a broken, heaving world and seek to keep our hands clean. God himself has dirt and blood on his hands as he does what good he can within the complicated system he has made and maintains for the ultimate good of the world. Again, to use my own words, what I hope is an epitome of Niebuhr's thought. Niebuhr encourages us to do what we can for all our faults and not to try to be more holy than God. Finally, then, a couple of remarks about the utility of Christianity. Reinhold Niebuhr found Christian symbols and stories to be necessary to explain the world we live in, to explain ourselves, and to explain our destiny. His challenge to those of other outlooks was simple, hard-headed, and confrontational on the shared turf, the common ground of contemporary life. Which view of things makes the most sense of all the pertinent data, leaving nothing out and keeping things in their proper relationship? Now, I've said that Niebuhr was sometimes called neo-orthodox, thus placing him in a set that includes mostly European thinkers such as Karl Barth and Emil Brunner. And Niebuhr was very hard on liberals who refused an orthodox view of Christ. But he did so not as an enemy of the tradition, but one who had come to believe that the tradition, that is, the orthodox tradition, did a better job in the real world than did the preferred pieties of his fellow liberals. He says this, quote, "The modern liberal Protestant interpretation of Christianity is obviously informed by and is an accommodation to the general presuppositions of modern culture. The optimism of this culture," again, remember when he's writing, "the optimism of this culture makes the central message of the gospel, dealing with sin, grace, forgiveness, and justification, seem totally irrelevant. The effort is made by such liberals to maintain some contact with the traditional faith by affirming simply that Jesus was a very, very, very good man." By the way, that to me is the single most devastating critique ever leveled at liberal theology. Liberals try to maintain connection with the tradition by affirming that Jesus was a very, very, very good man. But back to Niebuhr. "But that, of course, a better man might appear at a future date, in which case the loyalty of the faithful would be transferred to him. These moderns," Niebuhr is saying, "do not understand that they cannot transcend the relativities of history by the number of superlatives which they add to their moral estimate of Jesus." End quote. Yet, having flayed liberalism, he was himself a liberal. In both his own estimation, he called himself a liberal, and in the estimation of others, who see him as more in the liberal tradition than any other. In particular, Niebuhr's disbelief in some particular aspects of theological orthodoxy, or perhaps it was just a strategic rhetorical avoidance, such as the literal truth of the Bible, and the importance of the church, particularly as a political agent, this avoidance of such things in Niebuhr's speech and writing had a Niebuhrianly ironic effect. Yes, on the one hand, this public language that avoided some of the more scandalous views of orthodoxy let him speak in places that likely would have resisted any such explicit and traditional Christian emphases. So in some ways he was more effective because he jettisoned certain parts of the orthodox tradition. But, ironically, it also robbed his speaking and writing of the power of a strong exegetical expositional base in the Bible, as it ignored the traditional claim that the Christian story does in fact describe the way things literally are. Now, this claim that orthodoxy makes, to historical veracity, if sustainable. I realize that's a big if. But it actually would have strengthened Niebuhr's own position and in Niebuhr's own preferred way, empirical validity. To put it simply, Reinhold Niebuhr would have had a much more powerful biblical case to make if he could have claimed, we should see that this is the way things are today because this is what actually happened in the past as the Bible says it did. And I find it tragic, from my point of view, that he felt he couldn't say that. Because I think he could have. And we should, if we can. And this theological outlook, furthermore, kept him from offering much in the way of reflection on how the church, as an institution, could best involve itself in public life. Niebuhr writes very little about that. And this is guidance that we need today, especially in regard to the religious right in the United States and politically active churches in many other places, such as Latin America, China, and elsewhere. How should the church, as an institution, and not just as a bunch of well-intentioned individuals, how should the church function on behalf of justice and the highest ideal of love? Niebuhr gives us actually very little explicit advice in that regard. Some, but not much. To conclude, I believe that Reinhold Niebuhr's legacy is a rich and motivating one. Those of us who are Christians can follow his example. In particular, we need to recognize and engage in public theology today as a dimension, yes, of the Christian mission to the world, but also as a dimension of Christian citizenship, in which thoughtful Christians contribute what we can out of our particular tradition to our society's general conversation about our life together. So first, we need to follow his example. And secondly, we need to retrieve many of Reinhold Niebuhr's particular themes and emphases, as I hope I've begun to indicate today. In particular, we must be properly realistic and faithfully active. And third and finally, we need to pray the prayer that Reinhold Niebuhr composed that has inspired and directed millions. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. One of the great pleasures of lecturing at this time of day is that one can slide almost anything past an audience, because people, of course, naturally fade in and out, as I myself did for several parts in that lecture. So I'm looking forward to whatever you might have been able to hang on to during that long time, and if there are things I can clarify or things you can help me understand better, I'll be glad for that. I have about 4:15, and we will be done here no later than 5:30. So if you're checking your clocks to see where you need to be, we'll be done by 5:30. I'll check with Gord Cartner. Gord, is there anything you need to say at the end? Do I need to save any time for the fellowship? Okay, so we can go to 5:30. Thank you. Please.
Yeah, I think in his use of Scripture, the place to find that is in his preaching.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes. John?
Thank you very much. Your presentation of Niebuhr was rather pulling down from the head of Zeus. And I'm a historian. I would like to possibly somewhere indicate how his life's time, his life's career, maybe he reached this point. And you presented some cool reflection.
Right.
Whether
everybody could hear John's comment okay? And I would be delighted to hear a lecture like that myself, or to give it, and prepared to do so. I just didn't find a way of doing both of these things within the hour given to me. So, as a historian myself, I share your concern for such things. So let me offer one or two remarks in response, as well as this remark of sympathy to your point. The view of Niebuhr's thought that I'm giving today, as I think generally acknowledged as his mature thought by the time of his great works, particularly The Nature and Destiny of Man, also Faith and History, and a few other books as well. The expositors on whom I lean most, for example, Robin Lovin and Langdon Gilkey, do present a pretty coherent view of Niebuhr, while also, helpfully in their books, which I've listed in the bibliography, give you some sense of the evolution of his thought. Richard Whiteman Fox's biography does some of that as well. So this very interesting question of the evolution of his thought is available in the literature fairly transparently. And yet it's also, I'm glad to say, such, I think, a fairly good consensus of what they think and what I think from reading Niebuhr as well, that by the time when one reaches the early 1940s, Nature and Destiny of Man, 1941, 1943, the contours of Niebuhr's thought are pretty well set, and they don't change very much until the end of his career. So the 30s are the time of his evolution, from being a pretty lefty, politically liberal pastor in Detroit, to, as he works out his views, into their, generally what people understand to be their full exposition in The Nature and Destiny of Man. And many of Niebuhr's fans, as well as some of his critics, say that once you have read The Nature and Destiny of Man, and not much else, you see the themes of Niebuhr's thought, which he then just kind of keeps working out for another 20 or so years. So in that regard, there wasn't that much of a historical tale to tell once you get to that zone. And for me, that was where I really wanted to focus today. But how he gets there is, of course, very interesting, and something I would do in another part. Thanks, John. Yes, please, George. Thank you. Well, yes, I think most people say, yes, I'm a realist, except for those who are feeling particularly down, who will call themselves cynics, and those who perhaps have doubled up on their medication who might call themselves idealists. But yes, most of us would say we're realistic. But what's interesting is that this tag has stuck. I mean, Christian realism, capital C, capital R, is the accepted term for a number of thinkers that emerged in the 1930s with Niebuhr at the head. He's not the only one, but he that's the one you'd look it up in a dictionary or an encyclopedia, and that's what you'd find. But in terms of these other realisms that you mentioned, to go backwards in your questions, George, The best answer is I don't know to both of those interesting questions. Did Niebuhr's thought conflate with these other two? I don't know, and I haven't seen indication yet in the secondary literature that they did. The little bit I know about Straussianism makes me think, no, they didn't. And that last one, I'd be astounded, actually, to find that out. But that would make a great discovery to find that Leo Strauss's cabal at the University of Chicago was somehow connected with Niebuhr over in Union Seminary. I would be surprised at that, but maybe that would be an interesting master thesis. And I don't know about the International Relations School as to how much there was a connection there as well. I think we'd have to ask a true Niebuhr expert, which I'm not. So I appreciate that, and I will try to find out. And maybe in 6 months you can ask me again, and I'll know. The interesting thing, I think, also, then, about your first question about the impact on Niebuhr's thought of the atomic bomb, my understanding is that not only with Niebuhr, but on many, many Americans, there was not an immediate impact. That the atomic bomb was understood to be a really effective way of finishing a war, and was seen to be a really big bomb. And that only some people really understood what was happening, and what new age this might be ushering in. One thinks of the scientists, and particularly of, what's his name, who cites the Bhagavad Gita so famously, at the head of the Manhattan Project.
Oppenheimer.
Yeah, Oppenheimer, right? And he seemed to understand, you know, I have become death destroyer of worlds, that this is a really big deal. Whereas my sense is that many people in America saw this as just simply the end of the war. After all, there was lots of devastation to pick from. And in some ways, the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for some people, seems to be hard to pick out from the firebombing of Dresden, which they'd already accommodated themselves to in some ways. So I have not seen in Niebuhr's writing that I have read personally, nor in his commentators, a remark that the atomic age did anything other than intensify Niebuhr's concerns along the same lines over the subsequent 15 years. But it wasn't, it seems to me, it wasn't for him a kind of brand new era, except that the concerns he had were now intensified because the stakes had become higher. And the not only did America have the bomb, but Russia had the bomb, and he was, of course, very concerned about that as that moved on in life. But it didn't shape the categories of his thought. It was more like those categories were set by the early 1940s, and then he applied them in his incredible output of journalism, op-ed writing, and books, and so on. Now, I'm happy to hear from those of you who know Niebuhr's later writing better than I, but that's the sense I have, is that, again, the categories are pretty well set, and within those, he then speaks to the issues of the day. Thanks. No. Please, Terry.
Yes, thank you for an excellent presentation. Your thought, and just a couple of brief comments.
Mm-hmm.
One, neither Niebuhr nor his colleague John Bennett liked the term Christian lyricism, but it stuck because of the various reasons, and you can see why. And a comment on Morgenthaler, who was heavily influenced by Niebuhr, that was that school of thought, and Bach failed again, of course, the transcendent paradox of the Niebuhr. In my experience, so many of the critics and many of the devotees of Niebuhr had trouble with the paradox, putting them together.
Yeah.
They would go one side or the other. And being realistic about the self-interest in international affairs and of nations is what the moment of the world went, but the transcendent critique of that, and calling us to something better, even if not ultimate, I think gets me.
Thank you. Some of you may not know Professor Terry Anderson. Did I understand you introduced to me correctly as Niebuhr's last teaching assistant?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. So when he says this is a decent lecture, I feel much better now than I did an hour ago when I was introduced to him that way. Oh, really? Oh, wow. Yes, I had guessed that there was a personal connection there by that. Thank you.
For those of you who are preachers here, or even if you're teachers, I just tell one little story. I was going up the elevator once to Niebuhr, and he was, a student was saying, but sir, how do we explain this to our parishioners, these complicated paradigms? And there was a pause, and Niebuhr said, don't ask me, I'm in the wholesale department, not the retail department.
Yes. Please, Mark.
Yeah, for example, that, like much else in the book, Mark, you said, you just did similar treatment for paradox, because one said, well, the Testament itself, this is not an opportunity. That's just on the way from the at least this comes to paradox. The question I want to raise to you, for John, has to do with this comparing issue in the book of the nature and extent of the physicism. Now, clearly he avoids that physicistic over-empiricism, no, non-empiricism.
Non-empiricism, yeah.
But he's not quite physicistic or physicistic enough in your case. Again, that's the rule of the book, yet kind of minimally physicistic, I suppose. And yet, even this minimal physicism strikes an outsider to the discourse. One of the potential conversation partners, for which I think we have to serve the kind of introduction, as maximalist in its way, because it turns, as you pointed out, on the particular condition of centrality, Jesus Christ, for understanding the nature and destiny of the race. We live in an injury for which it's defined as the moment between disclosure in Christ and fulfillment. Really, once you said that, seems to me, you really said, just by asking at least to say, from the setting of a biblical figure of thought, for a kind of schema, this is what in fact defines the Christian sense of reality. And if you accept that definition, that minimally and maximal definition, then of course, Christianity will provide a more realistic account of reality. It seems to me that would be the sticking point that as soon as you started the conversation, outside the realm of biblical understanding.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Let me say a couple things back to that helpful comment. First, I think that Niebuhr's agenda is a pretty transparently apologetic one. Niebuhr, among other agendas, but a pretty high agenda for him, is in fact to commend the Christian faith to the culture of his day. And that's why, for a good deal of the attention in his works, is apologetic in terms not of trying to prove that Christianity is true, which is a classic way of engaging in apologetics, but it's not Niebuhr's way. Niebuhr's way is, in fact, fairly systematically to look at the extant alternatives and say, these cannot do as good a job of explaining and thematizing experience as the Christian symbols will. And since we're all obliged to pick the best symbols we can, I think these are the best ones. Try them on. So in that sense, it's both public and confessional, right? It's quite clearly prejudiced, convinced of a particular point of view, but also engaging in that kind of literal give and take. So it's not, I don't think, a kind of, well, once you've allowed for Jesus Christ, the rest falls into place, voila, Christianity's better. Well, sure, but that's not what Niebuhr actually thinks he's doing. In fact, in that sense, Niebuhr is not nearly as presuppositional as some Christians would be. Niebuhr really does think, and Gilkey puts it very strong in his exposition, that Niebuhr thinks he's looking at the world as it really is and finding that Christian symbols make the best sense of it. And that, he feels, is his own biography. Because even though he was a Christian minister, he looks back and says, I wasn't really very Christian back then. I was really a Marxist who enjoyed having a Christian platform to preach a kind of sanitized Marxism to my Detroit car industry labor parishioners. So that's at least his own sense. Now, we might, of course, look at this differently from the outside, but that's his own testimony to this. So I think that's an enduring challenge for all of us, whatever our worldviews are. We all come with, of course, a particular set of presuppositions. If we're going to have public engagement, then the question is, whose ideas, at least in this particular case, can do the best job of helping us understand things? And as happens with the Morgenthaler case that's mentioned, some people will take some of it and not the whole thing, and maybe that will be helpful, and even as an approximate or as a partial use of those categories. Niebuhr, of course, would like everybody to come all the way in. Now, do I understand what you're saying, Mark, or have I talked past you?
No, that's what I was just talking about very early in your outlining of the reality that we have seen. You're already talking in terms of the specific confession. That it seems to me that as a device for the
That's right. Right. Yes, and I have a lot of sad experience to add to your testimony. One proceeds too quickly to a gospel call. One loses one's audience fairly quickly in some circles. I think what I would say is to rescue Niebuhr from the compression of my exposition today. The Niebuhr actually does an awful lot of front loading. And in The Nature and Destiny of Man, there are a couple hundred pages of this fairly general exposition of Western intellectual history before he starts moving into Christian analysis. In fact, most of Volume 1 is of that sort, with Christian categories hovering in the background, but nothing like a kind of, therefore, you should become Christians because this is the better worldview. So I suspect, in fact, that Niebuhr would, I mean, I know Niebuhr would be very sympathetic with that, and in fact, some of his Christian critics have said Niebuhr was far too slow to use explicitly Christian categories. When he should have deployed them for our taste, and particularly folks from my tribe who wish he had opened the Bible a little sooner in some of these conversations. So thank you for that. Thank you very much for your attention, and it's been a delight to be with you, and I'll send you on your way, unless there's anything else to be said. Good. Okay. Thank you. Cheers.